Chapter 2. Lost. I was about to leave the house when the phone rang. I picked it up, hop-skippity-door keys in my hand. Hello? A pause. My mother. She only had to say one sentence. It was this. I had a phone call from St. Thomas's Hospital. And then I knew. I knew that my father had died. I knew he was dead because that was the sentence she said after the pause, and she used a voice I'd never heard before to say it. Dead. I was on the floor. My legs broke, buckled, and I was sitting on the carpet, phone pressed against my right ear, listening to my mother and staring at that little ball of reindeer moss on the bookshelf, impossibly light, a buoyant tangle of hard grey stems with sharp, dusty tips, and quiet spaces that were air in between them. And Mum was saying there was nothing they could do at the hospital. It was his heart, I think. Nothing could be done. You don't have to come back tonight. Don't come back. It's a long way, and it's late, and it's such a long drive, and you don't need to come back. And, of course, this was nonsense. Neither of us knew what the hell could or should be done, or what this was, except both of us and my brother, too. All of us were clinging to a world already gone. I put down the phone. The keys were still in my hand. In that world already gone, I was going for dinner with Christina, my Australian philosopher friend, who'd been there all along, sitting on the sofa when the phone rang. Her white face stared at me. I told her what had happened, and insisted we still go to the restaurant because we'd booked a table. Of course we should go. And we did go, and we ordered, and the food came, and I didn't eat it. The waiter was upset, wanted to know if anything was wrong. Well, I think Christina told him. I can't remember her doing so, but he did something quite extraordinary. He disappeared, then reappeared at the table with an expression of anxious concern, and a double chocolate brownie with ice cream and a sprig of mint stuck in the top, on the house, dusted with cocoa powder and icing sugar, on a black plate. I stared at it. That is ridiculous, I thought. Then, what is it? I pulled the mint out of the ice cream, held it up, looked at its two small leaves and its tiny cut stem smeared with chocolate, and thought, this isn't going to grow again. Touched and bewildered that a waiter had thought that free cake and ice cream would comfort me, I looked at the cut end of the mint. It reminded me of something. I groped for what it could be. And then I was back, 3 days ago, back in Hampshire, out in the garden on a bright March weekend, wincing because I saw Dad had a nasty cut on his forearm. You hurt yourself, I said. Oh, that, he said, threading another spring onto the trampoline we were building for my niece. Oh, I did that the other day. I can't remember how. On something or other. It'll be all right, though. It'll be healed soon. It's healing fine. That was when the old world leaned in, whispered farewells and was gone. I ran into the night. I had to drive back to Hampshire. I had to go now, because the cut would not. It would not heal. Here's a word, bereavement, or bereaved, bereft. It's from the Old English, bereavian, meaning to deprive of, take away, seize, rob. Robbed, seized. It happens to everyone, but you feel it alone. Shocking loss isn't to be shared, no matter how hard you try. Imagine, I said back then to some friends, in an earnest attempt to explain. Imagine your whole family is in a room. Yes, all of them. All the people you love. So then what happens is someone comes into the room and punches you all in the stomach, each one of you, really hard. So you're all on the floor, right? So the thing is, you all share the same kind of pain, exactly the same, but you're too busy experiencing total agony to feel anything other than completely alone. That's what it's like. I finished my little speech in triumph, convinced that I'd hit upon the perfect way to explain how it felt.